Welcome to the Niagara Friedberg Conference call of February the 1st. I'm David Rothberg, and I'm the CIO and the chairman of Niagara Capital, and with me is Al Friedberg, the chief investment officer and the portfolio manager of the Friedberg Global Macro Hedge Fund. Good morning, Albert.
Good morning.
Good morning. Just a quick note on format. What we're going to do is observe the usual one. That's to say, I'm going to act as the interlocutor to Albert and ask him questions about positioning. And then we're going to talk a little bit about risk today, given the circumstances of the fund. And then we're going to open the door to questions that have been emailed to us already. If you have questions that you want to have answered, we'll do our best to do it. We've got a lot in the queue, but please send them to erott, E-R-O-T-T, at niagaracapital.ca. That's erott of niagaracapital.ca. Just before we begin, I have a happy announcement to make, and that is that the Niagara Discovery Fund, a fund that we've been incubating in the form of an Ontario limited partnership for the past 4 years, is finally going to open next Monday. We're going to have a Cayman Master Fund and an offshore feeder fund an onshore feeder fund for U.S. Taxables and U.S. non-taxables and international investors. The fund, as I say, has been operating as an Ontario limited partnership for the past 4 years. The returns have been good. They've been diversified or not correlated to other returns. If you're interested, please get in touch with Eddie Rott, also erott at niagaracapital.ca. If you're a Friedberg client, you can speak to your Friedberg representative, and they have all the information. Okay, Al, let's begin, shall we?
Yes, sir.
Let's start with talking about the positioning, and then, as I say, we'll talk a little bit about risk. The fund is in the midst of its worst drawdown since it began now 10 years ago. We're in our 10th anniversary, or close to our 10th anniversary year. Let's talk to begin with about positioning. Basically, the fund is oriented bearishly.
All right, let me start by saying that what I'm about to say has already been said in our newsletter, and actually I'm only going to do some of the review very quickly. And that is the background and the positions, and then we're going to take the questions, which I think are more interesting. The current strategy that we have is based on three premises, and the premises are as follows. Number one, continue rising global commodity prices. That's propelled, as we have discussed in the past many times, by easy money, especially easy money policy of the U.S., that feeds the local money supply and feeds the money supply, the global money supply in a sense, and expresses itself in some of the most sensitive assets. In this particular cycle, the effect has been most pronounced in commodity prices. And we see this every day. Commodity prices are rising very quickly. Many of them are making multi-year highs. Some of them are even making historic highs. So that's premise number one. Premise number two, and by the way, we don't see that changing very quickly unless there's some very significant change in monetary policy in the U.S. and abroad. Number two, accelerating, let's say, inflationary pressures in emerging markets, Asia and Latin America in particular, which is beginning or is prompting a slow but excruciatingly slow tightening of monetary policy in those places. This is a long process. These countries all are starting to raise interest rates, all are starting to raise reserve requirements for commercial banks, but they are unfortunately still at very negative real rates. So therefore, the process is a long one. Third, the impossibility of the European periphery to grow out of their debt predicament. To us, that's a given. We don't believe that you can pile more debt on the existing debt. These countries need to grow out of it, and the only way to grow out of this is first to address the main problem, which is the periphery of Europe. has actually outpriced itself. Local inflation has made them not competitive vis-a-vis their northern members and vis-a-vis the world. And there's no way that Spain, Portugal, Greece can negotiate their way out of their debt. So there's going to have to be some type of an adjustment, and one of the adjustments will have to be, only one will have to be a default or some kind of restructuring of their debt. But the second one has to be something related to the level of the currency, which, because they're tied to the euro, they can't do very much about it. So these three premises suggest for now the following. One, a long position in a broad range of commodities, such as grains, metals, oil, sugar, cotton, so on, which is a position that we have, a good substantial position of these. Number two, a short position in the equity markets of the emerging markets, of the emerging countries, which are most affected by this inflation. And I mean, I can list all the countries at the moment affected by rising and accelerating inflation, but the important ones and the large ones are the ones that constitute part of the BRIC, which is India, China, and Brazil. And in fact, actually, Russia is also going through some inflationary problems. But India, China, and Brazil are facing now an accelerating rate of inflation, and monetary conditions there are negative and will become more negative as the year goes on. That spells lower prices for their stocks. Number three, a long position in credit protection of some European peripheral countries. As I said before, these countries need to at some point to restructure, and no cosmetic will help them. Nothing, maybe we'll have a chance to discuss more of that later, but the point is that nothing that is not substantial that can address those problems can help them. Number four, a bet that real interest rates in the developed economies, as for example the U.S., which are practicing some form of aggressively easy monetary policy, turned negative. That real interest rates turn negative, even in long-term instruments. And the way we bet that is through the purchase of inflation-linked securities. Number five, a bet that, contrary to what we just said, deflation will be the inevitable outcome of the tight-fisted German-led European Central Bank. Europe has parted ways with the central banks of the United States, UK, and Japan. They maintain a very tight monetary policy at the moment. Year-over-year growth rates of money and credit have been pretty close to zero. And the Germans are not likely to give in very easily to requests for QE, let's say. Now, the way to play that would be through the purchase. The way we play that through the purchase of German 10-year bonds. They have a risk, and the risk is that as and if Germany allows itself to be drawn into more guarantees to the rest of Europe, the bonds will begin to be are already affected and will be affected even more, and will. The rates will begin to converge with the rates on other European countries' debt. And finally, a long position in gold, which is expected to benefit from the consequence of all the above, that is, the world moving away from stable conditions and stumbling into another economic crisis. So I've given you three premises, and I've given you six positions, in a way, six major positions to take advantage of this scenario that we outlined.
Let me address just briefly, if I may, the final two suggestions that you make, just to flesh them out a bit. Are you suggesting with your long position in German Bunds that you're making a political judgment as to Germany's position vis-a-vis the rest of Europe? And as far as gold is concerned, for the longest time, your view of gold was premised on its becoming a type of money that would be used as that would be purchased by Asian central banks who have a relatively small amount of it by comparison to European central banks. Is that, has this morphed a bit?
Okay, let me start with the first. The purchase of bonds was not predicated originally on any political move. Actually, the purchase of the bonds was predicated simply on deflation and credit quality. The Germans have the best credit quality in the world, in developed countries anyway, and one of the strongest economies, and also the fact that the European Central Bank has a very narrow mandate to keep inflation down, as opposed, for instance, to the dual mandate that the Fed has. The Fed's mandate is blurred by the fact that they also must keep employment conditions good. But the original bet on the bonds was an economic bet, purely an economic bet. Sometime in the at the beginning of the last quarter, as the European crisis progressed, and as a bailout was conceived, or at least partial bailout was conceived, it became somewhat obvious to the market, and we were less than quick in reacting to that, that Germany would eventually be the one to guarantee and pay for all this. That they would be the only ones that can stand behind the guarantee and the funding for this country. So the market began to take the view that German credit is great and German credit is good, but if it begins to guarantee other people's credit, then its credit would be diluted. And it has had a substantial correction as a result. Bonds which traded at yields of close to 2% are back over 3.5%, or back over 3.25% anyway. And that is a result of that. Now, is it a political bet? Now, at this moment, it's becoming more of a political bet. And the question is this: we have a good reason to be long, but we also have a risk, as I mentioned before, and the risk is, will Germany come to the aid of all these countries? Will they write a blank check? Will they write a blank check of $1 trillion? And as against that, we think, we're taking the view that they probably won't. We're taking the view that the German public will not allow itself to be led into this open-ended guarantee, and that they will try, and they've already shown that they are resisting a lot of these type of pressures. They're resisting a unity bond, a unity, a European bond. So we think that they may try to do that just by making it look like they are, that they are doing it, but they're not really doing it, because we haven't seen anything like that. An example this morning, there was word that the bailout fund, the rescue fund, would be allowed to buy directly, or would allow the countries like Greece and Ireland and so on to buy their own bonds directly, so they would give them money from this rescue fund. Well, the rescue fund, as we all know, is led by Germany, and it's the largest contributor, the largest guarantor anyway. So the question is, so Jerry's view question is a political bet. It has become now a question whether Germany will go through with it, and we tend to think that, number one, the German public won't allow that to happen, that Merkel will not be able to come out with a categoric statement or categoric endorsement that's necessary, which could be 700 billion or 1 trillion. Remember, as you begin to rescue more countries like Spain and Portugal, Spain and Portugal no longer can then be part of the guarantee of new funds because they're receiving funds.
Right.
And so increasingly, it's falling on the shoulders of Germany. So we think that politically will be very difficult for her to do that. And we also understand that there's been a constitutional challenge, and that it's a very well documented constitutional challenge, and the Supreme Court, or at least the Constitutional Court, when it comes to the issues of European unity, will be looking at it in the next few weeks, and maybe coming down with some type of a resolution. So the answer is yes and no. So that's number one. Number two. The gold is really our case for gold has been and continues to be the main reason for gold continues to be that gold is money that the Asian central banks have a very small proportion of their reserves in gold, and that increasingly they will continue to increase that. They will continue to buy it. The reason why that hasn't happened till now, or the reason why that hasn't happened in large enough quantities till now, because it has happened, is that the market is still relatively small. The amount of trading a day does not accommodate easily their needs. And therefore, I refer to the question of lack of stability. The market is right now saying gold should be sold because there's more stability in the world economy, it's because the U.S. is doing better, because Europe is doing a little better, and so on. I'm addressing that issue, and what I'm saying directly is that no, economic stability is not in the cards in the next 12 months, but yes, the main driving force for high gold prices is that at some point in the future, central banks in Europe will increase their gold holdings, and we're talking about levels that are much, much higher than here, multiples of what they are here today.
Let's talk, let's move over into the commodity space at large. You've conceptually, or you want to conceptually balance your portfolio, so whereas you're bearish in equity securities, you have an aggressive long position in commodities. And yet, in your recent fourth quarter report, you speak about a temporal nature to the commodity bull market. You think that ultimately the raising of rates in Asia is going to break that market. So my question is, how are you looking, what are you using to gauge the timing of your decision?
Well, I think I addressed that before. You know, I said that that it's an excruciatingly slow process, that the central banks in Asia are moving very slowly, and so are the countries like Brazil moving very slowly to do something about it. I don't see the U.S. tightening, and therefore, and I don't see the European, I don't see Asia allowing their currencies to float upwards freely. I see them moving very, 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 very slowly and very tentatively to higher rates. So I think the answer to your question would be then, when I see real rates, positive real rates in Asia, in Latin America, then I'll say that, you know, we are close. We are very close, if not there.
So can you have positive real rates in Latin America and Asia and negative real rates in you can.
Yes.
And you will have at that point no longer strong commodity markets. Weak when you have negative real rates. Can commodity markets be weak when you have negative real rates in North America and positive
yes.
real rates in you can?
Yeah, the answer is yes.
Okay.
Asia and Latin America have been the biggest, and Asia by far the largest buyer of commodities. So we're really speaking only about Asia. I mean, the U.S. and the U.S. is today a very small part of the total picture.
Okay. I think I'm going to migrate into some of the questions before we start talking
sure.
about risk. There are surprisingly a large number of questions about your view on Australian banks.
Yes.
You indicated in your letter, I'm quoting one here, that being short Australian banks, the premises you discussed today do not seem to explain this move. Could you elaborate, please?
Right. So that's one of the subordinated plays that we have, one of the smaller plays that we have, actually. Australia is not the one of the main premises, it's one of the main plays, but the I'm of the belief that the Australian housing market has gotten out of hand, that incomes to house prices to incomes have gotten out of hand historically, that the banking system there is very, very heavily concentrated in mortgages, and that something similar, nothing is exactly the same, but something similar to what happened in the U.S. Is likely to happen in Australia when the commodity boom is over. And since equity markets are discounting mechanisms rather than reacting to events immediately, I believe that you're going to see, the example would be, for instance, what we saw in the U.S., right, where the stock market began to fall in 2007. The recession didn't actually take place until late 2008. So, and stock prices already went down earlier. So, I think something similar will happen in Australia, where the Australian banks will get hit very badly with some of their loans. And so, as I say, that's a secondary issue, a secondary theme, but we think that that's an interesting theme too.
Okay. Thank you. Here's a question I'm reading from an old friend of the firm. Hello, Albert. With great interest, I always read your quarterly report. Here's two questions for you. As U.S. debt soars, do you think the United States will lose its AAA rating, and the euro being in trouble and perhaps unlikely to survive in its present form, what effect will that have on the United States?
Oh, boy. That's a complicated question. It's complicated because this AAA business is a very relative thing. It's no longer what it used to be, and it's hard to say what forms or what makes a AAA. I think over time, AAA has migrated to lower levels of quality than it used to be at one time. And so, I mean, there were some of the tranches in this subprime mortgage fiasco. Some of those were called AAA, and they were nothing but junk. So I got a problem with that. Now, maybe the question should be, will the U.S. Lose its most creditworthy, rating? Maybe that's the question. And the answer is yes. I think that not only the U.S., but I think that the European countries, I think that the whole world, I don't think that there will be a sovereign that will, in 30 years from now, have the most creditworthy rating. I think that there will be corporations that will be better, that will have better credit ratings than countries. And that's because they have not only an enormous deficit, and you can see, for instance, President Obama spoke a couple of weeks ago, and in the face of this enormous debt, all he can say is that we're going to freeze a few hundred billion dollars of spending for the next 4 years. So there's really no real conscience of what to do or how to do it, or there's no guts in none of the countries, not just United, but none of the countries. So, but that superimposed on that is the clock that's ticking, the pension fund clock that's ticking, and that's huge. That's absolutely huge. I think that 30 years from now, debts of 100% of GDP will look like credit-worthy things. I believe that when you add the pension liabilities, you're talking about 300 to 500 to 600%. And these are numbers not calculated by me, but were calculated by the World Bank and the IMF and so on. We're talking about enormous, enormous debt and literally unpayable. Maybe not in our lifetime, meaning maybe not in the next 30 years, but we're getting close. 2030, 2040 is when that debt explodes. So you want the answer, will the U.S. lose its creditworthiness or the top creditworthy position? Yes, it will.
Okay. Let me apologize for lying and saying I would ask you no more questions before we got to risk. There's one more that keep me pouring in. It's your view of the euro and of foreign exchange markets generally, and then we'll turn to the questions of risk.
I don't really have a very strong view of this. I probably would skip that question. You know, I don't really think that the euro is a complicated animal, because on the one hand, it's strong because of Germany and some of the satellite countries like Netherlands, Austria, which are doing well. And on the other hand, it's got the problem that it's overvalued in relation to Spain, Portugal, Ireland, Greece. So it's difficult to know what the outcome will be. I mean, if these four or five countries leave the euro will be very much stronger. But if they don't leave, it may put some pressure on them. So I don't have really a good view of that. As far as the U.S. dollar is concerned, I don't think that the U.S. is doing much worse than anyone else. And so I think that at this level, the U.S. is probably still a decent currency in which to hold most assets on the average.
Just in the interest of disclosure, have you made any changes to your foreign exchange bets since
the quarterly
report was published?
No.
Okay. All right, so let's turn to risk. We're in the midst of the worst drawdown that we've had since the fund began in 2001, and many investors are concerned about how you're managing the risk. We know that what you like to do is to generate positive rolling 12-month returns. You haven't wanted to see a drawdown of more than 15%. You're paying close attention to daily volatility. You're trying to manage the portfolio in a way that's conceptually hedged. But I think that what's happened with the views that you have is that you're facing one of the prime dilemmas that any investor faces. That is that on one hand, you don't want to get on a crowded bus, but on the other hand, you don't want to fight the market. And it's somewhere between those two poles that is the sweet spot from a risk management point of view, surely. What are your thoughts? What are you thinking?
I think everything that you said was right. I think that, we look at rolling returns, and I understand that our rolling return for January is minus 3.8, which is, I think, the first time in 11 years that we are down on a rolling return basis.
It is.
I look at going forward, and actually, if we didn't do anything, by the end of February, we should be up, because last February was quite a bit down. Was actually down as much as we are down now in January. So that gives me a little bit of comfort. But I think that it's concerning. The concerning part is timing, and that's always been the problem of most portfolio managers. I mean, they may have a good view. They may have a view that will work out. But if the manager is early or too early, he will suffer quite a bit, and sometimes he may not be able to stay long enough to take advantage of the situation. So what we have done is we have sort of taken a little bit of an unconventional approach and have said, there is a number of markets that we have fairly large positions in. Why don't we give these markets why don't we put some arbitrary, absolutely arbitrary stops for parts of the position. And as an example, we did in the last few days put a stop on a small part of the position in gold and liquidated a small part of it. We probably would do the same with some of the larger markets if they don't act or don't react properly in the next few days and weeks. And I think that that's the only way that I think that you can do it, other than seeing something that will make us change our mind on the overall picture. I think that's the main, for us, that's the main thing. We need to see that our scenario is not about to come through. For example, we need to see a very large, substantial shakeout in commodity prices that can tell us that maybe the commodity boom is over, and therefore premise number one is no longer there. Or we need to see, for instance, that Germany will come out categorically and unconditionally behind the European countries and say, we are prepared to guarantee up to $1 trillion worth of their debt. And in that case, of course, premise number three would be gone. And so I think that that would be sort of the ultimate way of dealing with it. But in the interim, I think that what we've done is basically done what I just said before, which is taking some arbitrary numbers and saying, well, perhaps the position should be reduced. Should it be going against us longer than that?
Which ones are you speaking of?
Well, obviously the main positions are at the moment gold, bonds, tips, which are depend on the real rates. Those are probably and credit defaults, the credit defaults may not be there simply because the credit defaults have, we know, a very clear risk level that we can calculate and we can know what it is over the next 3 years. But at least the first three would be there.
So is it do you have a formula in mind?
No formula. I mean, we use mostly what you call points, low points or significant low points or significant new lows, that type of thing. You know, they're not formulas, but they're more taken out of the lexicon of technical analysis.
I see. Okay. So in other words, for commodity traders who are listening, a kind of analog to stops on charts.
Exactly.
Okay. Is there a limit to how much of a drawdown you're prepared to live with? That's a very tough question to put to you.
No.
Okay.
But obviously, the limit has already been breached, meaning in our minds that is already unacceptable, and therefore we are already beginning to put into effect this plan.
I think that's what people want to know.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Now, we try to keep things between a half an hour and 40 minutes. Despite all the questions, we've pretty well covered all the territory. Is there anything else you think that the investors would like to know?
Well, the investors should know that the manager is continuously concerned at all times. He's always thinking about the positions. So we're thinking how to improve positions, how to make them more effective, how to maybe balance them better. And I think I mentioned that in our letter lately, that in our last letter, that it was difficult in this environment to find a good balance to the positions as we had, for instance, in 2007 and 2008. But we are constantly thinking about it, and we're constantly looking to do that. And so they can rest assured, at least, that we're trying our best.
Good. All right. Well, I'll thank you very much for your time. If there are things that we didn't manage to cover on the call, I'd encourage listeners to email questions to Eddie Rott, and we'll try and answer them privately. And other than that, I wish you a good investing month. Thank you very much for your time this morning, Albert. Good luck going forward.
Bye-bye.